This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
No, I'd rather. I don't want to sound repetitive.
Can you hear us okay?
Very good.
Hello.
Yeah. Hello.
Hello.
This is the Nerdist Podcast. We're here at Comics Comedy Club in New York.
That's almost too much comedy, I think, in a comedy club.
Comics Comedy Club.
But this is where I happen to be performing this weekend. We're sitting with Jim Gaffigan, who's here.
Hooray! Oh,
thank you. Morning zoo clap. I like it.
Yeah.
All right, Jim. So, this is good. What do you got?
Here comes the comedy train. I can't.
It's a Johnny Z and the Dickhead show. We sent Dickhead out to clean up some porta potties.
We were just talking about stand-up comedy books that we read when we were younger, and I said I had read Stand-Up Comedy, the book by Judy Carter when I was in college.
Yes.
And while I probably wouldn't read it now,
right.
It actually, you know, anything that gets you to think in the direction of writing is not a bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, also watching a lot of comedy, like watching the comedy you like and then just picking that apart, I think is just as good.
Yep.
Yeah.
What did you watch when you were growing up? You're younger. You're a lot younger than I am.
I'm younger. Yeah. But a decade, right?
Let's not. Why would you have to quantify it?
I grew up watching, you know, Comedy Central really got going when I was like in like fifth and sixth grade.
That's adorable. I was in college watching the Comedy Channel, watching the Higgins boys and Gruber and Mark Maron on the Comedy Channel.
Yeah,
before it was
yeah.
Comedy Central.
There was like the A-List was on, and there was also those compilation shows on Comedy Central like Stand Up and Short Attention Span Theater,
which were the death knell of all those. Here's 10 comics talking about the same thing.
There was like Exit 36 that Amy Sedaris.
That was Exit 57.
Yeah. Exit 56.
But that was after that. Those sketch shows came on after Kids in the Hall was over, and it was like that Vacant Lot, which had Mark McKinney's brother and what's the other guy's name, but. Is this code?
Yep, it's recording.
I don't know. I just watched what was... There was no comedy scene in Hawaii that was good comedy. It's all just racial-based in Hawaii. Do you perform in Hawaii ever?
I'm actually going to Hawaii in May.
Oh, really? Where in Oahu?
In Maui and the Blaisdell Center.
The Blaisdell Arena. That's where I saw my first concert, Metallica.
Now, even though Jonah looks like he is from Portland, he is actually, he's Hawaiian. He was actually born and raised in
a native Hawaiian.
He is a native Hawaiian.
Yeah, well, my family's been there.
A little Filipino there.
Just a little bit. Just a smidge.
Yeah, yeah. I love vinegar so much.
Is that a thing that Filipinos love?
A lot of Filipino food has vinegar. I guess, see, that's the kind of thing. There's no nothing from my upbringing really can be equated to making people understand.
There's not a lot of universality.
No, none, really. It's like every time people ask me why I don't talk about Hawaii or growing up there, it's just because there's so much else you have to know to to understand why I don't like Samoans, or there's just a lot you gotta know.
Some Samoan's gonna hit you in the face.
It's happened before. It'll be just like growing up.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
So Jim Gaffigan,
yes, sir.
When you first started, when you were doing comedy, what shows did you do, your first television shows?
The first show I did was Caroline's Comedy Hour.
Nice.
Which was very exciting. And but I there's no Comedy Central when I started, obviously. And but I remember watching MTV Half Hour Comedy Hour.
Yeah.
And watching it and going, you know what? I think I can do this. So it was kind of...
Especially that show. I feel like I remember Half Hour Comedy Hours being it was okay, but it wasn't...
Yeah, it wasn't, but some of it is just like any season of any stand-up show.
Right.
Once you get to that third one, that third season, then they're like, all right, what else do we got?
That's when other people start getting opportunities. People get shunned.
Yeah. By the way, I don't think Caroline's has changed their set or color scheme in that club since that time. It's still that purple, yellow, orange, or whatever it is.
And also, I did Caroline's probably their fifth season. So I'm part of that same element.
The colors of the Harlequin they went with Caroline's.
It was very exciting. And I was terrified. And it was a big to-do, because that was it's like, I feel like stand-up comedy, you're always trying to build up credentials to have legitimacy, to stop that conversation. I mean, it feels like it's different now, but back then it was very much, oh, you're a comedian? Have you been on Letterman?
Right.
Or The Tonight Show? No. Have you been on any of these, Evening at the Improv? No. Then you're just a lunatic.
You're just a sadist.
With podcasts and everything, and the underground alternative scene, people, I think, have a different context for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's guys like Jake Johansson who've done Letterman. I mean, you've done Letterman a bunch, too.
Yeah.
I think he's done it, I don't know how many times he's done it, but I think
it's close to 30, or maybe 40 times.
40 times.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Do you find that people are recognizing you from the Letterman appearances or from the talk show appearances, or do you feel like it doesn't have the same impact that it used to have?
Yeah, no one really. I mean, the Letterman thing—it's weird because it's obviously with all these shows like The Daily Show and Colbert and the Kardashians and all this other.
Are they doing stand-up on the Kardashians now? That'd be amazing.
All these options. There's no. There's no nighttime destination to watch these.
There's no
shows.
Focal point of any entertainment.
I mean, I would say, Letterman some, Conan some, the nerds, like me that would watch Conan, but other than that, not really. It would never change your life. Supposedly there's the story of I can't remember his name, but, if you did The Tonight Show, obviously it would change your life, but also if you did The Tonight Show and you announced the date, it would sell it out. But, now we all know you do a TV appearance, and it doesn't even sell tickets.
No, yeah. Not a ripple, one ticket.
Well, that's what Drew was talking about, where he said he was like the day after he did Carson.
Drew Carey.
It was like the day after he did Carson, his life was different from then on.
Wow.
He said that he doesn't see that happening to anybody anymore.
Definitely not. I mean, are you glad that you started when you did, or do you think it, did the thought of just starting right now, is that terrifying to you, or do you feel like there are more opportunities now?
I think it would be better to start now.
Yeah.
Because I think that when I started in that post cable, short attention span, kind of in that era, maybe not short attention span, but A&E and MTV Half Hour Comedy Hour had kind of, there was a comedy boom in the 80s, And so then in the 90s, you know, all of them closed, but then there were all these comics. So there was no stage.
Where do we go?
So it's, and this is before,
it's almost like a homeless problem.
Yeah. Like, it's like, there was no, like, there was no alternative scene. There was no bringer shows.
Right.
It was literally, you know, you take a train out to Long Island and see if you can get on their showcase show.
Right.
You know, or you bring four people to, I mean, even though I said that there's no bringer shows, but there was like maybe a bringer show at the Boston Comedy Club. But there would be open mics with just literally insane people. And I would do poetry readings, you know. There was no option.
How do they take that at the poetry reading when you're trying to do comedy? Are they like, you're not taking the art seriously? Or did they find it refreshing?
Well, yeah, there's different poetry readings. You know, there's, you know, the poetry slam stuff that I wouldn't do. But, yeah, they're pretty crazy. They're like comics. They're pretty crazy. You know what I mean? They're so into themselves. They don't know what's going on necessarily. They have a peer group that they might pay attention to. But it kind of, you know, definitely influenced some of my writing and, you know.
This next poem is called Stop Fingering Me, Daddy. And now comedian Jim Gaffigan.
Oh, yeah, come on. It was a lot of that stuff. Yeah. I was a little bit of a break from some of that heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would go sometimes, when I was starting off, I would sometimes go to like a music open mic and say, hey, do you mind if I'm trying to do stand-up, do you mind if I just do a few minutes? And they're like, yeah, they would get excited because it would be a break from, you know, all these sad sack acoustic guitar guys.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I remember another kind of sad sack.
The first time I ever saw you in person, I was at the Aspen Comedy Festival in 99. Wow. I did a little comedy movie, and the film program for the Aspen Comedy Festival, or the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival, formerly in Aspen, Colorado, they were just starting a film program, so they brought us out there, and you were the guy that everyone was talking about. After we saw you perform, like, holy shit, that guy was fucking amazing.
Oh, really?
And then, yeah, seriously.
It never feels like that.
That's a decade-old compliment.
Yeah.
I mean, people...
What did they say 10 years ago?
I mean, I know this has sort of become kind of the bane of your existence, but people were talking about the Hot Pocket bit for, you know... I saw you in Jordan Brady's movie, the I Am Comic movie, which was awesome.
Oh, really?
Really great movie. And just sort of seeing what happened and... The fact that the Hot Pocket company sends a guy dressed like a fucking Hot Pocket to your shows. I saw one at the when you premiered your hour, your last hour special.
Yeah, it's very, you know, that's, you know, that was, you know, that was my agent thinking, you know, like my television agent thing, hey, this would be funny, I'll invite the Hot Pocket after we had sent cease and desist orders and all this stuff. But no, but like the, you know, it's weird. It's like the Hot Pocket thing. It's like, you know, I never do it outside. You know, I'll do it at theater shows. I'm an observational, you know. I'll do it at the end because the people would be like furious. So like, I drove an hour and a half for my 15-year-old son to hear that.
To hear the words Hot Pocket come out of your mouth.
Yeah, and but there is something about that. You know, it's an incredible blessing. It changed my life. But it's like, you know. You know, thank God for the popularity of that bacon chunk. But it's like now Beyond the Pale is, it was licensed to CMT. So, like, there's a whole other audience.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
But it's all good. You know, it's hard to complain. You know, it's kind of like,
course.
I'm so tired of getting massages. You know what I mean? It's like,
we call that complain bragging.
Yeah.
I've run out of pockets to stuff cash in. This is terrible.
But it is like, you know, I don't need... You know, people yelling Hot Pocket. I mean, people...
Literally, when you're just walking down
people
the street.
Just literally go, Hot Pocket.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's just like, all right, you know, I get it.
And to you, it's just a thing. It's just a bit that you wrote.
It's just one of them, you know.
If you had another... Do you have another bit you would rather people yell at you?
Maybe say, hey, Jim.
Jim, how are you? I hope you're well.
I know that bit.
How's your family? How are things?
But it's pretty strange. I mean, but prior to the Hot Pocket thing, there were, you know, if people knew who I was, it was because of this manatee bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, there, you know, hopefully it'll change. You know, I mean, you know, this is all the perception business. So you're, like, known as the guy who did this. You're the guy from this. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm sure you've had three different ones, right?
I've had a few. The guy
and
from the... Yeah.
And there's a little bit of... You know, initially you're kind of like, wow, they actually know who I am. And then you're like, well, I'm not just the guy from the boat show.
Right,
you know
right, right.
I'm not just the guy from the dating show.
But what's so funny is that people... they, you know, when they see you on television, they get very comfortable with you, yeah. and they feel like, I can say anything to that guy. And then they come up to you, and they kind of want to, in a weird way, control you like a puppet. Do that thing you do, or say that. Like, they want to control you like a video game. And but they also feel like it's okay. I don't know if they feel like it's okay to be honest, or if they feel like, hey, everyone probably kissed this guy's ass. I'm going to lay it on the line for him. If someone after the boat, after Shipmates started, came up to me and was like, hey, bro, saw your latest show. Not your best work. Like, I'm a human being.
Yeah, no. Well, I feel like, I mean, I have two things to say about that. Like, one of them, I was literally recently in the San Francisco airport. Great food in the San Francisco airport.
Yeah.
And so I ordered a meal from a Mexican place, and they give you, like, one of those flashing things where you stand there, and then they flash. So you can't leave. So I'm kind of, like, there, got my receipt, got my flashing thing. And this guy comes up to me, and he goes... And he's, like, in the Hollister shirt, and he's, like, early 20s, and he's like, hey, has anyone ever told you you look like Philip Seymour Hoffman? I go, yeah, I get that a lot. And he goes, so are you? I go, no, I'm not Philip Seymour Hoffman. But again, if in any other situation, I would just leave.
Right, you know? Right.
But I'm kind of trapped. And so he goes, so then he goes, well, why do you sound like him? And I'm like, I was like, well, maybe I sound similar to him, but I'm not him. I get that a lot. I'm taller than him and much better looking. And so I tried to, and so then he goes, yeah, well, I think you are him. And I'm like, well, you know, I told my wife later, she was like, why don't you just show him your ID? I'm like, because he doesn't need to see my ID.
He's not an official.
And he wouldn't leave. He was just kind of like, and this is not some insane person. This is like a guy in his 20s who's traveling, who's just like, that's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I'm an indie film detective, and I just need to make sure you're not Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He refused
sure
to let it in because he thought that I was Philip Seymour Hoffman denying just to end the conversation. So it was like, eventually he was like, I'm just going to tell people I met you. And I go, go ahead. That's fine.
What was his next, like, if you said, yes, I am Philip Seymour Hoffman, he's like, okay. And then, like, what would be his next thing? It seemed like that was his
Twitter.
I have this creepy role I need you to play in a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been planning on raping your face for a while, and let's just go in the closet.
I just didn't want to make another mistake.
You know, it'd be funny if he went over to, like, the airport house phone and paid Philip Seymour Hoffman and then just waited to see if he picked up the phone. Like, that was his test.
Yeah, it was very strange. But there's something weird about it because there is something about, like, I identify with, like, when you would see someone, like, I remember, like, you know, I've lived in New York for 20 years, and I saw Paul Reiser on the street, you know, 15 or 18 years ago, and I was like, holy shit, that's Paul Reiser. And so I went up to him, and I said, hey, enjoy your stuff, and I left. But I would... You know, maybe it's the Midwestern in me, but I wouldn't corner him and kind of like say, hey, so what do you do this? How do we do that? You know,
it's a bad combination when you get recognized by a flawed human being and you know that they're just not going to let you go. Yeah.
But the irony is also that like the same gumption that it takes to go on stage is the same gumption that someone would have to approach them. So like really these people coming up to you are in a way us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same audacity.
Although I feel like I'm terrified to go up to people and say anything to them, and it's very rare that I do, but, like, did I talk about meeting Steve Martin on this podcast already?
No.
I can't remember if I did. I haven't. When I went back to perform at Aspen, to do stand-up at Aspen in 2001, I was at the St. Regis Hotel, which is sort of the main hub at the festival, and Steve Martin was just sitting in the lobby, and he was my idol. A comedy idol, and I went up, and you know, I was totally out of breath, and I just immediately went into fanboy mode, and then his eyes just kind of glazed over. I mean, there was no, this is really, you're the reason I do comedy, and like all these words were rushing to get out of my mouth at once, and I couldn't quite do it, and it was, and I wasn't the show me your driver's license,
right?
Yeah,
but
So there's something innocent behind it.
Yeah, you want to connect with the people that you see. You want to feel like, you know, hey, you've given me stuff. I just want to tell you hi.
They're very complimentary.
Very sweet, yes.
Yeah. And, it's like, if in my case, if I'm holding my 3-year-old son who's just like, you know, filled his diaper or whatever.
Right.
It's like, it's not time for like a photo. Yeah. You know what I mean? Hey, can I get my picture with you? It's
hey,
like,
look at this fucking guy. No, yeah. My kids are right here. Could you not, yeah. Could you not yell to your friends?
I was in Vegas once and I was walking through the lobby and I saw Stephen Wright, and I was a huge Stephen Wright fan growing up. And I was just like, I was kind of been up all night and really messed up. And I was like, I just want to say thank you. You know, just like, hey, I really like your stuff. You know, I didn't want to like, get into a conversation with him or anything, but I went up and I was like, Mr. Wright, I just want to say my name's Jonah and I'm a really big fan of yours. I do comedy now, and you know, you were a big part of that when I was growing up. And then he's like, oh wow, thanks man. And then but he had food and I was like, well, nice. He's like, so what are you doing in Vegas? And I was like, oh well, I just, yeah, I'm here for a friend's thing, just hanging out, but I know you're busy. He's like, oh cool man. Well, and then we just ended up he wanted to talk, and we ended up talking for about 45 minutes just like shooting the shit. Like
at the end of the conversation, he was like, all right, I'm getting the line, I'm just going to wrap up this conversation with one more thing. That's how good he is. 45 minutes.
He's very tight in conversation.
And then you said he invited you to the show.
Yeah, I started walking away. Wow. He's like, hey Jonah. And I was like, hey, so would you and your friends want to come to the show tonight? And I was like, fucking hey, right, yeah. Like I was so, like, it was really just, he was so awesome, like, and so nice and very
the point
inviting.
Of that story
the
is
the sad thing is at the end he goes, Stephen Wright said, I bet you would, see you later, bro. And he flipped you the bird.
He flew me the bird.
Why would he do that? But it was in a very dry way that was hilarious.
Yes. Whatever he does is funny.
I think it'd be great if you were like, and he was so high energy and he was hopping around. Yeah, silly.
I asked him what was in his bag. Guess what? Props. He had all these props that he made. That's how he kills time on the road.
Have you ever seen, there were a few like seminal stand-up comedy specials for me when I was growing up. One of them was the Ninth Annual Young Comedians, but the Rodney Dangerfield Ninth Annual Young Comedians. I don't know why that one stuck out, but it was like Kinison and Louis Anderson and Rita Rudner and Saget was on it, and all the, you know, it was a big deal at the time.
Yeah.
And then there was another one in the 90s that was like Janine and Judd Apatow and Kindler was on it.
Drake Sather,
I think, was on that. Yeah, yes.
Right.
And Kindler was this like skinny, wiry kid who jumped around the stage like a mad hobbit. And just when you know his, I mean, he's one of my favorites, but when you know his act now, he just kind of stands in one place.
Yeah.
But watching him jump around and go, ugh! Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Did you ever do any of those Young Comedian specials?
No. That was, you know, I always had wanted to. But it's amazing when you look at those specials now, like some of them were like at Catch a Rising Star, mm-hmm. and some, it's like literally, it was definitely pioneer times, because, you know, I mean, comedy is, some of it's, you know, it's timing specific, but like some of those you're like, whoa, you know, like it's, you know, sometimes there's new faces at Aspen or whatever, and, you know, then, you know, a year later they're like, I'm a publicist now.
Right, right.
Like, these, you know, that those HBO comedy specials, that was like the cream of the crop.
They all launched.
And some of those people, you're like, you know, it wasn't working. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
It's like, it's not just the fact that it was, you know, it's 2010 and it was 78.
Right.
It was just like, wow. That was the cream of the crop then.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Now, I one of my favorite things about, because I've seen you live many times, play at the Wiltern last year. Is you write in a way that I wish I could write, but I think of your, and I hope you take this as a compliment, but I see what you do as sort of a really comprehensive Wikipedia thing where you introduce a topic and then you manage to hit it from as many angles as seems humanly possible, and every joke is just as strong as the one that was before it. I mean, what's your process? Like, do you just go, oh, this thing that I kind of want to tackle, and then you just start writing punches for it?
Well, there is, you know, Jeannie and I, you know, my wife Jeannie, it's you know, it's like, you know, you do stand-up for a couple of years, and you just end up getting into a certain kind of method of mm-hmm. doing it, and you might evolve and change, but some of it is, you know, the price of introducing a new topic, I feel, is kind of exhausting to the mm-hmm. audience. And there's also kind of like, you know, getting all the chicken off the bone. Everything's about food with me. It's like, so there is something about like, you know, you find a topic and then, you know, you tear it apart. And if you have like 10 jokes, then, you know, there can even be jokes that are not A's, but within the context of the other jokes, it can it can survive and be very helpful. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. I mean, it's weird. It's definitely like how Carlin did things, you know, or how I aspire, how he, you know, like his chunk on suicide, I think is
that's
just
one
like,
of my favorite pieces just, of comedy ever.
It's just so thorough and so like different styles of and different, you know, comedic approaches to one topic, and it's done in a very concise manner. And you know, his mastery of language was, you know, nothing that anyone can get close to. But I don't know, we just kind of write from, you know, the top down. I've never heard the Wikipedia thing.
It feels that's what it sort of feels like. It's like a topic and then all the angles on that topic.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, you know, and it's different, you know, different points of views, and it's placement stuff, you know. There's it's weird because like I have like certain topics, but you just get so sick of these topics. It's like, you know, we're working on whales, and there's the comedy cliche bag where you're like, you know, it's like I've got stuff on hotels, and it's just like it's like comedy cancer. You're like, well, I don't know how we're gonna we're in this. It's a new hour. We've got hotels, but like let's try and reinvent this based mm-hmm. on common knowledge of what is horrible, you know, like, you know, just the comforter being covered with, you know, sperm or whatever.
Right.
It's just like, let's try and make it
sperm whales.
You know,
do you see where we're going with this?
Yeah.
Whale hotels.
Well, that's, you know, so like there's something about being really thorough that, you know, I feel like gives you an allowance to be a little bit infantile and a little simple. And it seems to be working, but, you know, I don't know. It's like, I think comedians kind of write the way they write. You know, it's
right.
like Lewis Black just gets up there and, you know, obviously it's organized, but it's, you know, it's done from a passion and he just throws it out there and then he writes as he goes.
That's what Louis C.K. does. And Louis is another guy who's yeah. like, he's sort of like a coach, like a comedy coach in the way that,
yeah.
you know, I'd opened some shows for him and I said, it was something similar to what you said about hotels. Like, oh, I couldn't write a premise about, you know, airlines. It's so hacky. And he was like, hey, there's no hacky premises, only hacky delivery systems. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I see that. But I still, you know, and he's another guy that won't write anything down. He just goes up and works it out.
Right.
Yeah.
Which
I can't do
I'm
that.
Not as good at doing that. I kind of have to have a few
You know,
bullet
I have
points.
A horrible memory, and I'm also very, you know, mumbly, and I don't speak in complete sentences. So it's like, and I think wording and phrasing is so important, but, you know, like the hacky topic, turning it into something new is, I mean, I think there's no one like Brian Regan. You know,
oh my God,
like, yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, my wife and I, Jeannie, and we were talking about this, and it's like, you know, a lot of what I do is kind of like, very, you know, not stylistically, but it's my approach to stand-up, I feel, is very Brian Regan-like, you know, with Carlin and all that. And so there is something about, like, you know, I mean, I just think Brian Regan's, like, the best. But, you know, I mean, I'm very influenced by Attell, and Attell's very thorough, too.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And, you know, and also throwing a lot of stuff out. Attell throws, you know, it's like his crumbs would be anyone else's act.
Oh my God, you know? I saw him at the Improv once, and for some reason it just rubbed the crowd the wrong way,
yeah.
but I folded in half laughing so hard, he referred to Eskimos as snow Mexicans. And I thought that was the most amazing, just, it was just the way that he's like, God, Eskimos are like snow Mexicans! And maybe it was because we're in Los Angeles, and just
yeah,
the word
yeah.
Mexican can kind of,
yeah.
people automatically, the PC shutters just
yeah.
go up, but as a comic, I was like, oh my God, that's such brilliant imagery, even
yeah, well,
if it's slightly
yeah, and it
tells
un-PC. So much. It's like, it's just like, I'm one of these guys who just loves talking about comedy, so it's like, you got me on a tear. But like, Attell is like, I think, like one of the great comedic minds, and like his approach to stand-up is, you see it in Louis at CK, and you see it in Todd Barry, and you know, like there's some style, but it's all substance. Like Attell is like, feel free to despise me, but you will laugh at this joke. And so, like, it's, you know, it's the anti-salesmanship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
yeah.
the salesmanship in New York when I started was considered, you know, that's, like, the worst crime. The worst crime is to have, you know, to win them over, and they like you,
right.
And you trick them. It's the material and the jokes that are way more important. That's why Kevin Brennan has kind of his delivery, and Attell has, it's just a little bit of like, on your heels, the jokes will do the work, and it doesn't matter about you.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great, because you see, there's a whole generation of comics from that area, and I see that consistency.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I was starting to screw around with comedy in college, it was right when the whole Uncabaret, San Francisco alternative.
Yeah.
You know, and they know they hate that word. I know they hate the word, yeah, alternative. I just don't know what else to call it. But it was anti-joke. You were not allowed to tell jokes. You were not allowed to try, quote unquote. You had to just bring a notebook on stage and be like, and most of the jokes ended with, yeah, I don't know. So that was just something I thought. Yeah. And then this next thing.
And then something funny.
Yeah. And then it had to be something that happened to him that day or, you know. Yeah.
Right.
And then there was like this slow evolution process of like, you know, no matter what the audience is, they still want some jokes, you know, like maybe if it means changing your bank of references, that's a little more alternative, but still, you know, they still want to see jokes. Then it kind of evolved back into
jokes.
Into jokes.
Well, it's funny because like when I started doing open mics in LA around, you know, 2002, I know there was like, that's when, you know, Zach was like really, everyone loves Zach, and there was this
Galifianakis.
And it was all jokes. It was like there was all just one-linery kind of comics. Like BJ Novak was just like
Morgan Murphy, Dan Mance,
like all these comics were just. And I tried so hard to just to try and just be like a one-liner comic.
I'm a terrible one-liner comic. I can't do it.
I couldn't get my thoughts out so succinctly to be able to like. And but like everyone was doing. And Dimitri was doing that out here, and it was just that was all jokes, which is funny because it went from such a rambly place and just became.
But they were doing the. That's the thing with the with alternative comedy. It's just like it's at least one level of irony deep.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that they were doing, you know, they were doing one line jokes, but in a way that's like, I know these are one line jokes.
Yeah.
And so it was a different presentation. So it wasn't like a Catskill.
Well, that's what I loved about Galifianakis too, is that it seemed like he hated himself for what he was saying on stage, and it was just like it added a whole character level.
I loved watching him crush on the SNL monologue.
Amazing. Yeah. That's what it should be. That's what those monologues should be.
Did you see it? It was. I mean, it was just Zach doing being Zach, and you know, the piano, but it was so refreshing to see a genuinely funny person with an act,
right?
Like, and you put them before that audience, and I guess the opening sketch didn't go over as well, so they were starved for, you know, comedy. It's like, when was the last time you did a? Do you ever do like drop-ins on smaller rooms, like bringer rooms or whatever?
Yeah, definitely.
And my friend Andrew Donnelly said, oh, you know, you go into those bringer rooms, and if you're a comic who has any experience, you just fucking crush because people are so thirsty for, like, you know, like tested material and jokes, you know, and then you just clean up.
Yeah, I think that, to your point, like, the Zach thing is, like one of the most important, you know, this is going to sound really dramatic. It's one of the most important things for comedy, the success of Zach, because he's a substance guy who's not, like, he's not there because, and this is not a criticism of anyone. Everyone succeeding in stand-up is great.
Right.
But, like, Zach is kind of like, you know, Conan succeeding and Letterman succeeding. It's, like, the substance, there's a unique style, and it's, you know, that's great. You know, that's much better than, like, this presenter kind of mentality, you know, this, you know, reality show kind of like, you look at, I mean, I look at People Magazine, I don't even know who any of these fuckers are.
Right, right.
And I'm like, so it's like, so Zach is not going to be on the cover of Rolling Stone because he's cute.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, I think he's adorable.
He's so squeezable. No, you just want to pinch his beard.
When substance wins, it's always good.
Yeah.
That's not a criticism of anyone that's had success. I mean, Foxworthy succeeding, and, you know, Lewis Black and Dane, it's like, that's all good for comedy. And that's not a criticism of them. But, like, you know, Zach is, like, a unique kind of, like, you know, eccentric that's succeeding. Kind of like Conan is, like, a true nerd. So when he succeeded, it's like he was educating.
Mm-hmm. You know
what I mean?
Like when I, and I know she will, when Bamford hits big, that's going to be another one. I mean, it's like, it's such a, you know, I look at people like Zach and I look at people like Maria Bamford, and, you know, I feel like in my own writing,
you know, I can sort of work out what's funny, and then in front of a crowd I can fine tune it and connect with them, and you know, I get surprised a lot by what they like and what they don't like. But you look at people like Zach and Marie and you just go, they are coming from an entirely different plane. Like, that is a whole other, they just fucking breathe this specific comedy voice. And so, I'm not jealous in the sense, because I can't do it, and that's what they do. But I'm sort of jealous in a positive sense. Like, oh, it's so exciting that, you know, I wish I could be a part of that, because it's so amazing. But it's, I love watching it.
Yeah.
Cool. By the way, you and I have the same manager. I'm sure you might know that.
Oh, yes, I do know
and
that.
Before your last special, he goes, all right, Jim's got like 15 minutes on bowling, and it's going to piss you off. Because my dad was a professional bowler, and I have yet to write any bowling jokes because I'm too close to it. I couldn't figure out what's funny about it. I'm too, like, the stuff that, you know, that you're really close to in bowling, I could not make funny at all, and I was not mad. I was delighted by your 15 minutes of bowling material, and each joke I was like, why didn't I fucking, it was right there. Like, it was gorgeous.
Yeah, no, that's fun. It's, you know, it's weird. I wish there was, you know, it's like when you're an observational guy finding new and when you're a food observational guy finding new topics is like, you know, because there's also some, you know, it's like any junk food similar to Hot Pockets is Hot Pockets.
Right.
Any indulgence food similar to bacon or cake is an indulgence food.
Right.
So, like, where do you go from there? It's like, all right, you know, I've got, like, seafood stuff, but it's... And it's, you know, on this last special, I was like, I'm not going to do any food. No food whatsoever. And then, like, the bacon stuff came out. But it's weird. Like, the topic stuff, it's... You know, it's like there's no reason why I should even have a chunk on bowling. You know, I might set it up like I do bowling, but I never, you know, I wrote some, you know, we wrote some jokes on bowling and then we went bowling.
Mm-hmm.
But it's weird, you know, like, and it's, you know, it sounds dishonest, but it's kind of the observational kind of mentality. You know, it's like you can have a Cinnabon and write about it. But, like, there's some topics, you know, like camping. It's like, it's not like I go camping ever.
But I think that's totally within your wheelhouse. I mean, like, you know, because part of where you come from is like, I'm a lazy guy. I'm just this lazy guy.
Yeah.
And bowling, like, a lazy guy who likes to eat food, that's in that world.
Yeah.
It's totally in that world.
It fits that point of view. Yeah.
Did you kind of set out to have, you know, because, you know, I notice your specials have overall themes to them, you know, like the lazy white guy or the food theme. And like, do you set out to do that, or do you just write a bunch of stuff and take a step back and go, oh, I guess I'm writing about this, so we'll make it about this?
Well, you know, it's, there's, you know, there definitely is some rewriting. And, you know, it's like, you know, anyone who's dealt with a callback, you're like, oh, you know what, I could call this back here. So there is kind of some understanding, looking at it and seeing what an overall arc is. When you do a lot of hour shows, you know, you have to have the beginning, middle, and end. But I think it's weird. It's more of a message of how, you know, after, like, you know, they say 10 years, you learn your point of view. Mm-hmm. It's like there's a bit of me, you know, I am a lazy kind of food-obsessed guy, but... It's kind of strange when you see that point of view. I mean, you're the nerdist,
right?
You know what I mean? And so there, you know, there might have been some identification with that growing up all through your life. But like when you see that's your point of view, you know, like you guys, you know, the pie song and all mm-hmm. that. It's mm-hmm. like you're like, wow. So this is my identity. I mean, maybe you didn't have
no. I totally understand what you mean because it, you know, especially in LA, the way you. Do comedy. By the way, LA is the worst place to learn how to do comedy, and that's where I learned how to do comedy. It's you're writing jokes for an audience that is a 1/100th of what the rest of the audiences in the world are, and you know, if people laugh, usually what you're writing is too inside. Like, you can't do audition jokes in other places. But anyway, what happens is you can't really ever do long sets in Los Angeles, so you keep doing a collection of 7 to 12 minute sets in LA. Yeah. And you never, you know, until you go on the road, you don't get a sense of how everything fits together.
Right.
And it's, and then what I found was oh my God, I actually have a chunk about being from the South, and I never set out to be,
right.
I'm a Southerner, never. But, you know, like, you do like 10 different sets, and you write one kind of redneck joke in there, and then all of a sudden you realize, like, oh, that's something in me that was trying to get out that I didn't realize. So I completely understand your point about
it's
that.
It's very strange, too. And, you know, like, I talked to Louis C.K. about this, and he kind of, you know, he kind of reinvented himself. I mean, he was very kind of, he was an eccentric observationalist, and now he's kind of an autobiograph. I don't know how to describe him, you know, just kind of, you know, talking off the top of his head, biographical. He's much more biographical now. And so, like, there is something, you know, like, you can make a conscious effort to make that shift. But, you know, for me, it's like, there's some kind of, like, there's something about, like, you know, you write, and, you know, like, I remember when I first did my first special, everyone was like, it's unbelievable, there's no curse words, congratulations. You know what I mean? Here, welcome, bring the Christian right and the Mormons over, meet Jim Gaffigan. And the weird thing is like, that was not some elaborate plan or some, it was like, I literally had, like, curse words. Occasionally, when I would do Letterman or Conan, I would have to take them out, and then I'd have to rewrite, so I just took them out. Mm-hmm. And I also, you know, you have writing kind of assignments that you have for yourself. You know, like, you'll see that you're using a word too often. But so I took curse words out, kind of like just thinking that it was relatively uncreative of me to just throw in an F-bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And so the weird thing is like, then you get kind of... you get kind of put in the position where people are like, you're the food guy. Hey, food guy, lazy guy.
The
and so
F-bomb.
Then if I talk about, so if I go to something like, I, you know, we wrote this chunk on narcissism, you know, it's like I'm a darker person than my act. But
boo,
like,
that's not food.
No, but like, why do I if have I'm to... talking about narcissism, you know, either it's funny or not, but it's relatively new. There is a bit of, like, you know, the audience kind of like, ha 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 ha.
Is that some type of sandwich?
How does this fit into some sort of pocket?
Or, you know, so it is kind of like a, which is probably why Dane did that, you know, his last special, which was much more edgy. So it's like, it's weird how you, I'm not making any sense, but it's weird how the journey of your act and your point of view. Because I think that stand-up is all about, you know, how we were funny in real life and putting it on stage and making it appeal to a group. And it's that constant kind of movement of that and has you evolve, you know. So, like, Louis, you know, CK was always a brilliant writer, but now he's kind of transferring some of his, you know, single parenthood stuff on stage. And, you know, some of his anger associated with just the difficulties of life. And so he made that shift good. But, like, as you evolve, it's kind of like when you see, like, the really young comic who starts when he's 18 and he's really funny. And his persona is kind of stuck in that. And when you see him at 35 and he's doing the getting wasted shit.
Right.
It looks a little bit like, dude, you're 35 and you're talking about blackout drunk. That's like a red flag.
Right.
You know, I hope I'm making sense, but it's like, it's the audience kind of tells you who you are.
Well, it is it's a relationship. Like, you know, because there are some comics who kind of have the point of view of like, fuck you, audience. I'm going to say what I want to say and you're going to listen. If you like, you can go fuck yourself in the mouth. Yeah. And I sort of feel like, no, it's a relationship. You give to them. In return, the audience has to give a little bit back. They have to make some effort. So that the show is fun. They got to kind of come together and be willing to give it up. You can't always force them. And, you know, so I totally feel that, you know, it's a really perfect little ecosystem, you know, almost like weirdly Darwinian. You kind of are shaped by your environment in a weird sort of way.
Well, it's just because, you know, you're going, you say certain jokes and then, like, you realize, like, the kind of jokes that people respond to more. And so you lean towards that direction more and more, and then, like, that's how you become... who you are on stage.
I mean, you really, I know, do you write everything out like in detail or do you transcribe stuff?
Typically, yeah. I mean, it's there's something of just to rewrite it and, you know, word economy. I mean, I'm a slow talking guy. I'm very Attell like, which is machine gun, not long story with a big payoff. It's like, you know, you keep hitting them. So you want to be kind of Rod Carew or Ryan Sandberg rather than, you know, Barry Bonds.
Sports reference guys.
Yeah. And so
those guys are round ball shooters.
Yep.
And ball. So but that's the very Attell kind of approach, mm-hmm. you know, or even, you know, George Carlin, you know, it's like bing, 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 or even Seinfeld. I mean, Seinfeld is more, you know, kind of slow and easy. But the thing is, you know, that, you know, personality wise, I mean, there's definitely some of, you know, the inside voice. I'm a slow talker. And so the inside voice talking for the audience, I've kind of weeded it out a fair amount. But that was like a necessity in New York because I was slow talking. And then someone would say something, you know, they'd be like, yeah. And I'd be like, so I have to keep talking. And where people in New York, comics were louder, I would get more quiet. So it was a little bit of the E.F. Hutton thing.
Well, what's amazing about...
Another reference from 30 years ago.
E.F. Hutton. I remember the commercials. But I think that the inside voice was, you know, even if it was the byproduct of, you know, your environment or however you came to it, that's another one of those things where you're like, God damn it, that's so perfect. It just, I feel like it makes you bulletproof in a way that no matter how a joke goes... You can do that, and instantly the audience is on your side, and it's so spectacular.
Yeah, there's like, you know, I love it, and it's got to be selectively used, but it's also an additional point of view on a joke, so you can have your own individual point of view, but if I'm speaking for an audience member, they can have an additional point of view, and it can be critical but also funny. So the whole idea of, like, particularly if I'm wearing a topic down, the inside voice's point of view can address that. And if you address something, like, even if you're in an argument with a friend, if you communicate awareness to mm-hmm. them that you understand their point of view, you'll get a lot of credit for that. And so
I think Patton Oswalt worded it that way, is the highest form of comedy is exposing a truth. That's my Patton Oswalt. Was it like he was here? Was it like he was right here?
Yeah. I thought he was.
So yeah, like you're exposing a truth. I mean, I don't want to be too arty about it. So I don't mean to take it in that direction, but I do think you are. You're exposing a truth to the audience, and that's instantly funny to them because they're relating to it immediately.
Yeah.
The idea that I know, you know, you said weeding out the swears, which I really wish I could do. I swear too much on stage.
But, you know, some of it is... The strange thing is, like, you know, it's like... I mean, I could go off on this. America has, like, this obsession with, you know, we come from an art form that is built around attacking censorship. Mm-hmm. You know, Lenny Bruce and, you know, Carlin and all this stuff. And the whole notion of getting rid of curse words or working without props or, you know, it's just like, it's all relative. You know what I mean? It doesn't really mean anything. You know, like Louis Black, if he wasn't cursing, it wouldn't make sense.
His makes sense.
So it's like, and it's like your personality. I mean, I've known you for a while. It's like, you know, it's not as if, you know, like if your point of view tells you to curse, it does. There's nothing wrong with it. But if I'm talking about like details of an elevator or an escalator, it's not necessary,
right?
You know. But you know, there's also I listen to not that I listen to tons of comedy, but I have this Lenny Bruce thing on my iPod, and I was listening to it, and he actually says exactly what I just said. I'm copying him. No, he kind of, you know, like someone, you know, we kind of think of as this leader in censorship, right? And he was like, yeah, you know, the curse words, you know, I use them if it's necessary for the character, but otherwise I don't, because, you know, it's not necessary.
Well, that's the key. It's about economizing. And for me, I just feel like there are places where it's not necessary. Like, if you use the word fucking at the same that you would use just like word filler, then it's sort of unnecessary. And I feel... And I feel like it makes it more powerful if you can economize and use it where it's necessary. Like in Bill Cosby's himself special, where the only swear word he says is, you know, something about like, my friend says he takes cocaine because it intensifies your personality. And I said, what if you're an asshole? And it's the only time he swore in that special. And it was like thunderous applause because it was so well used in that in that context.
But there's also, you know, if you're cursing, if you're doing a spot at Largo, cursing is
part of the vernacular.
It's not like it's not going to have the effect. You know, like if you're doing a show at, you know, 1 a.m, you might need to curse to get their attention. So I just also think that, like, I mean, I really do believe this. Like, comedians do what they can do. And so, like, when people get credit for being this incredible social satirist, like, wow, he really went after Bush. It's like, no, that's how he writes.
Right.
That's his personality. Or, wow, this guy, he does great one-liners. It's like, no, that's how he writes.
That's him. That's
you know,
him.
I know him. Yeah. You know, he does great characters and he does great one-liners. You know, so like, I think there's, you know, there's too much credit or criticism given. You know, like people are like, you know, I remember like when Dane made it big, people were like, he's hopping all around the stage. I'm like, that's his personality. Yeah. That's what he does. So it's like, you know, the way he emotes and stuff like that. I just kind of feel like there's kind of, and this is also coming from the New Yorker who believes that you sit on your heel and the joke's more important than the personality. Mm-hmm. But there is, you know, I do believe that, like, comedians do what they can. So, like, if you are, you know, if you're Patton, it's like, that's Patton's thing, you know? And if you're Zach or Maria, you know, like, Bamford, it's like, no one else is doing that, right? But, you know, I'm sure there's some people, you know, she does those weird voices. It's like she's not doing weird voices. She's doing her comedy.
She's expressing.
She's actually doing normal voices. Her voice is the one that's weird.
That's the weird one.
So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny, you know, because obviously in the comedy circles, Dane is a big hot button for some people. Yeah. I mean, like, sends people into an incendiary rage.
Yeah.
I never had a problem with him. He was personally rude to me once, and that was sort of the fuck, really, all right. But you know, but I remember when I was younger and I would watch him and I thought he was a phenomenal writer, but then I just felt like the more famous he got, it just sort of became less about, like, I saw a special of his and there wasn't, you know, there weren't as many jokes. It was just more like, you know, when you're at the movie theater and the preview comes on and then you talk at it. And there was an applause break, and that was it. And I felt like, oh, fuck, I know you're smarter than that. Like, I know, like, go somewhere with it. And maybe that's just me being selfish.
He always confused me. Like, I always was confused by people loving it so much. Because I went to school, I was in Boston through 2006. So I was in college, and everyone was like, this is amazing, you have to listen to this. And I would listen to it, and I'd be like, he sounds like, you know, he's having a good time up there, but I don't really see it. I don't understand why you guys think this is the funniest thing.
Maybe now's a good time to introduce Matt Myra here. And,
sorry, Joe
Ray. I forgot you to. I didn't even introduce you.
I think the Dane thing is very interesting because, in full disclosure, I definitely, you know, I was this guy in New York struggling. He came down from Boston. You know, he did a set at the Cellar, and it was just like, you know. And so there was definitely jealousy, and you know, it was the antithesis of what I believe stylistically, which is the material is the king and you sit on your heels and you do it. But that being said, I mean, I think something to consider also with Dane, because I do think he is a good writer, but I also think that, like, success ruins everyone. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, how many, you know, I mean,
does that have to happen, though? Does it have to happen?
I don't even want to say names, but it's like, how many great specials of all of Carlin's specials are that great? Like, that special that we love, that Suicide.
The last two were great.
You know, but some of it is, like, there's parts of those where I'm like, not my bag, you know?
Yeah.
Bag like that.
Hey, groovy.
Not my bag.
You guys want to go pick up some foxy ladies?
Very hat.
Hey, guys, can you pass the grass?
But, you know, I can't believe I'm sitting here sounding like an... But the thing about Dane is, like, how many hours has he done?
Five? Oh, yeah.
He did, like, 2 hours in 1 year. And yeah. So, like,
Louis's on that track too, where he wanted to do the year. Carlin thing, where he's like, each year, whole new hour, and the whole year builds up to that hour, and then I shoot a special at the end.
Which is a very British thing, too.
For me, I feel like,
same bag.
Yeah, like bag.
It's the same bag in England bag.
Like farts or bum burps and
bum burps. No, but like, you know, it, you know, supposedly at Edinburgh, I've never been there, but you know, you write a new hour every year.
Wow.
And I'm like, well, you know, how about you could either do that or you could do really good jokes, you know.
But that's, that would be the other alternative.
That's a cultural thing. But I do think that, you know, I mean, you know, whether you're into Dane or not, it's undeniable that he is a really good comedian.
Well, he's a workhorse. And like, there's no question.
It's different things. You know, it's like, there's plenty of comics, you know, all of us individually that are very successful, and maybe you guys are looking at me and just going, you know, I don't get it. I just don't get it. There's plenty of people that get it, but I don't get it. And so, but I think that Dane's, you know, the explosion of his success, and then kind of like it was kind of the Sylvester Stallone thing where people felt like they could almost bond in bagging on him, bag again.
Yeah.
And
I know,
so
it became very, like, it became very chic in comedy circles to be like, fuck, you know, Dane Cook.
There's,
you know,
a contrarian spirit in me where I'm like, well, hold on.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean? And I don't, I mean, you know, if I would have better feelings about him if I didn't have a terrible experience with him, and it was, I should just say it because it's rather than just alluding something. But Mike Furman and I were performing at Aspen one year, and Dane was he was on the show right before us.
Yeah,
and he just went way long, and they were lighting him, and he was like, "I see the light," but then he like went over like a half hour.
Yeah,
and it wasn't like he had to get off on a good joke; he was fucking slaughtering the whole time. Right. And we had to cut our show short, and
yeah,
it just, he never, like, he was just kind of gruff about it, never apologized, and never, and
yeah,
you know, look, it's petty of me to even give a shit, but I just sort of feel like that was a moment where I was like, you know what, fuck you now, because, you know, like, I can't abide, you should just be cool to people. You should be cool.
That's you know, but that's the rock and roll mentality, right?
I know. And so, like, every interview where where they take out, and you know, interviews, you can talk for an hour and they'll pull out whatever chunks to create the perspective that they want. But, you know, when you see the perspective of him being like, yeah, I just reached really deep into my soul for this next special, and it's stuff like, what's up with chocolate or whatever? It's like, come on, you know, like
chocolate before.
You know, yeah.
But, you know, let's also consider this again on the apologist thing. It's like, this, first of all, we are people going on stage and making strangers laugh. We're fucking crazy.
Oh, to try to make people like us that we don't know is ultimately narcissistic.
We're trying to make strangers laugh. So, you know, red flag.
Right. That's the first. Let's start there.
Red flag.
Let's start there.
Okay. He also, you know, the success, you know, happened relatively young, happened fast, happened furious. And so it's like, and you know, like maybe he was never, no one went long before him. But in his belief system, you know, now I sound like some therapist. In his belief system, it's, you know, that's what you do. You go over and
there are a handful of comics who will walk into a club unannounced, and because they're famous, they'll do like an hour and a half, and every other young comic who's supposed to perform that night doesn't get to perform.
Or 7 hours.
But you know what's weird? It's like, I remember when Chris Rock was huge and he would do that at the comic strip. I was not angry at him. You know what I mean? But some of it was, you know, I mean, so there is, but you know, you were doing a two-man show, right?
Yeah, at the time,
So it's like, I was just doing a 15-minute spot. But I don't know, it's weird because there's something about, like, there's something about our culture that is just kind of like, you know, Dane was kind of like put in that mill where they're like, everyone loves him. Jennifer Aniston's friends with him. Blah, blah,
blah. Right.
And I'm just like, I just saw it coming. I was just like,
you know,
it's not going to end. You know, it's just going to be like, there's going to be a certain, you know, just, you know, either the public's going to turn on him, which it feels like they might have on some level.
He's still doing fine, though. Like, he sells out massive venues.
Yeah.
I mean, he will, I think, for a long time.
He just did Madison Square Garden like 2 months ago.
Is that a bringer room?
Yeah,
I'm gonna do a bringer show at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah,
you could.
Look, you can do an hour if you can show up with 30,000 people. Yeah, all right.
So, but there is something about, I mean, I'm also somebody, like, I just like to do my stuff and go, you know. Again, I'm crazy. I'm going on stage making strangers laugh.
When did you feel the shift? Because, I mean, just having had the same manager for quite a while, it was like, I've been there when you went from, you know, I don't know specific numbers. I'm guessing making like $2,000 a week at a comedy club doing seven shows. And then within a year, it was like, oh my God, Jim is selling out theaters. I mean, like, what, you know, I assume a lot of it had to do with the hour special.
It was, beyond the pale. And
you're a phenomenal online person, by the way. You have a phenomenal email list.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but it's like, you know, you look at Twitter and it's like, what do I got, 150,000? It's like, I've never been, you know, like, or even when I was on MySpace, it's like, I never had that many of them. I mean, I definitely worked it, which is a sin in comedy, right?
But it's smart.
And some of it was like, you know, panic, you know, it's like, I'm going to Phoenix. Hey, everyone from Phoenix, you come to my show. So there was some of that, but I feel like, you know, it was luck. I mean, I think some of why I could do what I did was the success of Dane, the success of the blue collar guys, the success of, you know, David Cross and Patton. So it's like, I was, you know, so maybe if someone bought Dane's album, maybe their second or third album might have been mine. And
especially with iTunes now, and you might
if
also
someone bought Patton's album, they might also have bought mine, and then you know, even Larry the Cable Guy, you know, like,
I never begrudge anyone, whether I like their comedy or not, I never begrudge anyone's success, because to get to that level is fucking hard work. Yeah. Like, it does not.
And it's a lot of luck.
It is luck, too.
It's a lot of luck. I mean, it's like my
hard work, you know, and luck.
You know, my hour special, it's like, it didn't have huge ratings or anything like that, but Comedy Central re-aired it, and, you know, eventually it just kind of got there. And, you know, from what it seems, it's like, when I was in college, it's like MTV was on in the dorm room, and, you know, and then I think during Beyond the Pale, Comedy Central was on in the dorm room, and now I don't know what's on, you know. But I don't know. I mean, so I think a lot of it, but I also have been, you know, I remember when I would go to cities and do, you know, the improvs or whatever, I would always sell well because, and it wasn't just, you know, like I kind of described it, like there was like always two elements. This is me being a narcissist, but, and there would be two elements. So like people would know me from the 70s show and stand up. So then they would go, they would know me from Sex and the City and stand up. And then they would go, or they would know me from Super Troopers and stand up. So there was a lot of different reason, not a huge reason to get people there,
but enough, yeah,
and a lot of luck, you know. And so, and a lot of people in that habit of maybe going to a theater because of Dane, you know.
Well, we're at the end of the hour, but we've been talking with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and who's an excellent comedian.
Have I sounded like a dick? I'm always nervous when I get in.
No, you don't sound like a dick. It is you have to understand that. It can be a dicey road just to start talking seriously about comedy, but it's not, because, you know, like, I feel like people who listen, and certainly the three of us, are just so fascinated by the process. I don't think we're not talking about it and coming from a place of like, hey man, we got comedy's number. We're coming from a place of curious, inquisitive people who want to see what your experience is like versus ours and other people's, because we're just trying to figure it out too.
It's like,
you know?
There's one thing you'll always find with comics is that, like, everyone has that story of just after a show going to like a diner and then talking till like 4 a.m. about comedy. And there's a certain type of person that gets that idea.
We live with it and we think about it nonstop.
Yeah. You know, and there's different philosophies. Like, it's like, I've had these conversations with like Jordan Rubin and Todd Glass and Ian Bagg, and, you know, going back like 18 years, me and Geraldo, you know, I remember Geraldo wanted to be like Brian Regan and I wanted to be like Dave Attell when we started, and then it kind of like flipped. You know? So it's kind of funny.
So Jim, you're on tour sort of constantly, right? It just, you do dates
throughout
the...
I'm trying to do a lot less just because I, you know, I went crazy. You go crazy doing that, you know? It's like traveling. I mean, maybe, you know, some people are, you know, but you just, it's, I was doing these shows and then I was doing meet and greets and I just kind of like, you go crazy where you're like, all right, let's drink. And then, you know, like, and then you wake up and you're just like, and then you get back home and you're toast. There's something about like when you go to like Phoenix and do the improv, where you're at least there every single day. But you know this, when you do, like, when you're, like, in an airport and connecting through, there's a certain emotional tax, I almost feel.
Oh, yeah.
It's a, you know, it's again, it's like complaining about,
right,
a, you know, an incredible gift.
Oh, this gold is so heavy on my back.
Yeah, no, but
I know what you mean.
It definitely makes you go crazy.
Well, thank you, Jim Gaffigan.
Thank you.
Gaffigan? Yeah. Do you know Jim Gaffigan? He's a comedian.
There's a C in there.
There's a C, a silent C. Thanks so much, man. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The end.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Nerdist Podcast. Just a couple of quick announcements before I release you into the wild. I do stand-up comedy live in front of people, and you should come out sometime. I don't want to build it up too much, but it'll be the greatest fucking show you've ever seen in your life. Monday, April 5th in Los Angeles, we'll be doing the Nerdist Podcast live at Largo. Our special guest will be Mr. Adam Savage of Mythbusters. Then on April 10th, I'll be going up to Seattle, Washington and performing with my buddy Mike Furman at the Showbox at the Market. Then, just added, do you live in or near Bloomington, Indiana? Sure you do! Well, then come out and see me perform from April 28th to May 1st at the Funny Bone. And as always, please watch Web Soup. It's a television show on G4. That's a network! For information on this and any other Nerdist-related stuff, go to Nerdist.com, naturally. And if you want to email us a question or a comment, you may do so at podcast@nerdist.com. Thanks again for listening, guys. Have a great rest of the whatever day it is you listen to this.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.